Welcome back to the second season of Sax Reel. This season is brought to you in part by Key Leaves. Are you suffering from sticky sax keys or striving to keep your instrument healthy? Check out Key Leaves and use the code SAXREEL for a special discount at keyleaves.com. That's key like a saxophone key and leaves like leaves keys open to dry. Key Leaves. Thanks for tuning into another episode. This week's guest I'm very excited about. He's the professor of saxophone at Georgia College. His articles have appeared in many major publications, and he's currently the tenor chair in the Palmetto Saxophone Quartet. I'm very happy to welcome Dr. Andrew Allen.
Thank you very much for having me, Jonathan. It's a pleasure.
So I always like to start off with a little bit of an introduction into how you got started with the saxophone and how you got to where you are now.
For me, I think my path is maybe a little different than some other people's, but I'm from an extremely small town in Middle Tennessee, a town called Gainesboro. But if anybody is familiar with Tennessee, it's about halfway in between Nashville and Knoxville. If anybody's really familiar with Tennessee, it's about half an hour north of Cookeville. But the county I grew up in, extremely rural, had about 10,000 people, only one town in it. And both of my parents come from a blue-collar background. My father worked in factories, was an expert maintenance repairman. My mother started out working in factories, and eventually she's still the office supervisor of the county health department where I'm from. They were extremely supportive. You know, my whole family, there's always been an arts bug. My both sets of grandparents, they never even really made it through high school, to my knowledge, any of them, but reading and education and music and art were always something that was very important. I was never going to be an athlete. And I think everybody figured that out because nobody in my family was ever going to be an athlete. But, you know, my grandfather's entire side of the family, they were all musicians. They were bluegrass musicians, but they were very serious. And there was a lot of talent and a lot of ability there. So pretty early on, all of my family encouraged me to sing. Originally, I grew up in a faith tradition that was pretty fundamental. They still did a lot of things resembling shape note singing. So singing was something that I started doing very early on. And then my mother got me involved in children's choir at Tennessee Tech, the Cumberland Children's Choir, which sadly no longer exists, when I was about 8. And that was one of my first exposures to real music making, because my little county K-8 school was so small, we never had a real music teacher. And then when I hit about the fourth grade, I was sitting in the school assembly in my little tiny K-8. And the high school band director had just been hired. They hadn't had a band there for 20 years. And this guy walks in, and this little first year band that he kind of scrambled together sits down and plays a suite from Aladdin because it had just come out. And I was 8 or 9 years old, and I thought that was the most beautiful thing I'd ever heard in my life. And looking back, you know, he'd had these people on instruments maybe 6 or 7 months by this point. Most of them were beginners, so it's probably pretty rough. I was hooked. I started playing in the fifth grade. My beginning band had 2 other kids in it. Eventually, I went to the county middle school, because if you were in eighth grade at the middle school, you got to do marching band. And before I did 9 years of marching band, that was a selling point. But I was very fortunate. The band had 30-something kids. I had the same band director from fifth grade all the way through high school. But there were a couple really good motivating factors. One of the 2 kids who was with me in that little K-8 band program would be a 2-year All-State saxophonist. He briefly studied music in college, and he's a physician's assistant now. I was always chasing him. And that was, I think, one of my first big motivators. Really quickly, I knew I wanted to play the saxophone. I just started playing the saxophone. Anybody who's ever spent any substantial time with me knows that the saxophone is it is the great obsession in my life, short of my wife. I pretty much just think and talk and do saxophone all day long. But I was from a very small town. I got involved pretty quickly in the whole routine that most high school kids do. You audition for a region band. You're around a bunch of other kids who play their instruments well, and you say, hey, this is really cool. Hey, we're playing some cool music. Hey, this is a lot of fun. I got hooked up very early on with the band director at Tennessee Tech, a guy named Joe Herman. And he was one of those college band directors that had a real gift for taking kids under their wings. And he would just contact me, get a hold of me, kind of helped me out. There wasn't a lot of money for private lessons until I was about halfway through high school, but my parents always made sure that there was money for summer camps and things like that. So I studied off and on with the saxophone teacher at Tech at the time, a guy named Jim Spinazzola, who was the assistant band director. Yeah, he was a a fine saxophonist. Just he was a wind conductor first. And the summer in between my junior and senior years of high school, he ended up leaving to work on his doctorate. And a guy named Phil Barham came in. And Phil really quickly turned my playing around, really started me down the path I'm on. I'd played a few standard pieces through my junior year. And then my senior year of high school, Phil put me through like a dozen hard pieces. I ended up playing the Muchinsky Concerto, which nobody ever plays, but it's a really nice piece, by the end of my senior year. And I was hooked. I studied with Phil all through undergrad. I got a music ed degree. I was really torn. I didn't know if I wanted to be a band director in Tennessee or if I wanted to keep going through grad school. But pretty quickly, I figured out, I want to try the saxophone thing. So I ended up going to Central Michigan to do my master's and studied with the great saxophone guru, John Nickel, who I still think is one of the absolute finest teachers, not just saxophone teachers, but he's a master teacher and a master musician, real artist teacher. And then studied a couple other places, did workshops and all the things everybody does, but ended up doing my doctorate with Cliff Lehman. Cliff and I are extremely simpatico. I hope he wouldn't hate this too much, but I've always considered himself and myself to be very much on the same level in terms of personality and musical approach. So it's always been a very good first teacher-student relationship. And Cliff has also been so excellent in immediately turning that into a colleague relationship. And I'm extremely grateful to him for that. And from there, I just got really lucky and I got some jobs and somehow they still let me do this for a living. And I'm hoping somebody doesn't find out one day and say, oh, you don't need to be here. So that's what I'm trying. Anyway.
I love that. That's awesome. That's such a cool story of like starting from a town that had almost no opportunities and somehow you made it all the way through a doctorate at really prestigious schools. That's very cool.
Well, and the nice thing is, you know, even in the smallest town, if the culture's right, that was a town where, yeah, football was a big thing, even though they always lost. Basketball was a huge thing, but there was also a tradition. There are several very well-known bluegrass musicians who came from the town and their names are on the sign. My name will never be on the sign, but that's okay. They still like me, so it's fun.
Well, I know since then you have been a really active member of our community as a saxophonist, obviously, and you've done a lot of writing in publications, like I mentioned in the introduction. I'm just wondering what made you want to do that and what really interests you and what kind of topics do you talk about?
I think the fact that I am a little hyperactive really helps with that. when I was a kid, both of my grandparents had the old sets of the World Book Encyclopedias. And I can still kind of regurgitate to you basically everything that was going on in the world in the mid-70s when those things
were. Oh, wow.
So I would sit there and read encyclopedias when I was a kid. And I've always had this weird relationship to just knowing facts. Mm-hmm. I actually did Jeopardy. Last round audition a few weeks ago. So we'll see what comes of that. Keep your fingers
crossed. That's so exciting.
But I've loved diving into information since I was probably 10 or 12 years old. And my wife will tell you, and most of my friends will tell you, I like to talk about the things that I like. I have a tendency to jabber on about things I'm interested in, and I'm a little monomaniacal. I'll just center on one thing and just learn every. I can't sleep at night, so I get on Wikipedia and I just like read. And my wife says,
productive use of time.
Yeah, exactly. And my wife says, so what are you reading about now? I'm reading about, I don't know. I'm just reading. Cool, great, go to sleep. But I found out I really like to learn things about the saxophone that people didn't know. Hey, that's kind of cool. You can still do that. Saxophone's a new enough thing. You can go down paths. I also figured out I write really quickly. It's a skill that I didn't really realize I had till I hit grad school, and I could turn out pages like kind of at a crazy rate. So I would get bored over the summer starting my master's. I just say to my friends who are band directors, what do you not know about the saxophone? What do you want to know? And they say, well, why do saxophones play out of tune? I said, they don't play out of tune, but here's what you're doing wrong. Okay, how do I say this to people who aren't my friends and they're not going to think that I'm a jerk? So I just started writing articles. At this point, I'm up to 40-something practitioner articles in The Instrumentalist.
And oh, my goodness.
It's kind of funny. Just try writing. Pick something that you think is common knowledge, but just talk to friends who are not saxophonists. You're probably going to land on something that you can spit out an article on, lickety split, that's going to get published. In terms of more more scholarly research, like I said, I fall down these holes and find things I'm really interested in, and I'm usually kind of shocked to realize that there isn't a lot of information out there. When I was at Central Michigan, John Nicol is a huge proponent of saxophone ensembles. He's been doing them forever. He does them extremely well. He's got all kinds of great arrangements for them, and it's something that's an important part of his curriculum that he does at least one semester every year and does them to a very high level. But I got really, really interested in the whole concept, and I started poking around for more information and realized, hey, nobody's done a history of these things yet. Mm-hmm. So when I got to USC, I said, well, I know what I'm going to do my dissertation on. Cranked out a couple articles on that. Then I realized, hey, Henry Cowell wrote a bunch of pieces for saxophone. Nobody's done really extensive investigation of this since a little bit by Paul Cohen back in the 70s. And there were even a couple pieces that were discovered after Paul Cohen had done that research. Now I've gone down another rabbit hole. I'm looking at leftist composers, especially heterodox leftist composers who use the saxophone as an indicator of proletarian struggle. So that's the new thing that I'm on. So if you're an editor or a editorial board member of the Saxymposium, ignore that you just heard that. But it's funny, you know, we all have our niches. We all have things that we're good at. And I think it's really important. Don't try to fit yourself in the mold of someone else. We all have different gifts. We all have different skills. We all have different strengths and weaknesses. And if you're trying to chase someone else's strengths and weaknesses, you're bound to fail. You're bound to be a poor imitation. But start identifying those things that you're good at, that you can do quickly or well, or maybe in a way that other people can't. And especially in crowded job markets, especially in kind of cutthroat job markets, or just in life in general, you're probably going to be a more successful, happier version of you if you can start to identify those things. This is me. This is no one else.
I love that. Yeah, that's so important too, because I feel like, I mean, everyone who's going through school right now knows the struggle of wanting to compare yourself to others. And I know I've talked about this with previous guests, but I love that point of like, find your niche, find what you love, find what you're good at, and kind of just dive into that. Something fruitful is going to come from that. So I love that yours is research. And I know you're writing a lot of articles, so, and they're super useful for everyone. So I really appreciate the work you've done with that.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that. I want them to be useful. So that means a lot to me.
And now for a word from our other sponsor, Consistency Wins. Consistency Wins was established in 2002 by Jonathan Cathell, who has over 30 years of experience working as an instrument technician. Aside from Jonathan Cathell, there are three other amazing technicians that work there: Jeremy Hill, Alex Singleton, and Courtney Christensen. All four technicians specialize in high-end setups and modifications. One thing that I really genuinely appreciate about Consistency Wins is that I know that they're not doing this just to gouge me for money. They're doing this because they genuinely love the instrument and they love making sure that we understand what they're doing. Consistency Wins doesn't use any gimmicky repair materials as a means to lure in musicians. Instead, they focus on how the instrument should properly function and provide helpful, myth-proof, tried, and tested information. This encourages less visits to the repair shop through the long-lasting services they provide. So if your instrument is out of repair and you're looking for someone who you can trust to do quality work, make sure you go to Consistency Wins. That's consistent, the letter C, wins.
So of course you didn't just write articles. That's not all you do. You definitely do a lot aside from that. I know you've worked pretty extensively with some really well-known composers. I'm always curious about that experience because, I mean, these are really important people in composition and in compositional history. So I think it's really cool that you've gotten to work with them. So what was it like to work with some of the larger named composers that you've had the chance to in the past?
Yeah, you know, I've been extremely fortunate. I've had relationships with a lot of great composers who are also great people, which I think is the key element here. But I've had pieces written by Francois Rosset that have been written for me, by the great Robert Lemay, by Mindy Fang, by Jesse Jones, by Greg Simon, by Annie Nykirk, and just a ton of other really, really fantastic composers. I've been really fortunate. For a lot of those, I've just been in the right place at the right time. Greg Simon is now a professor of composition at the University of Nebraska at Lincoln. But when I first met him, we were both kids at Brevard. I was a first-year grad student in between my first and second year of my master's. And Greg was the teaching assistant in the composition studio. he's just a nice guy. We had a couple beers. We got along really well. I listened to some of his music. I really enjoyed it. He's a magnificent jazz trumpet player, and that bleeds into his composition, but not quite in the way that you would expect, in a really interesting, uses these beautiful complex harmonies, this really airy, beautiful, expansive instrumentation, and just really interesting music. So we started collaborating early on, and that's still a really fruitful relationship. We need to touch base again, but we're actually talking about for some point in the future when we can play with large ensembles again, some kind of chamber concerto. And then Francois Rosset, I was lucky enough, I studied at GAP at the European University of Saxophone, and he was the special guest that year. And we didn't receive really great instructions. We had just been given a couple pieces by him and said, hey, start to learn one of these. And they didn't say anything else. So I picked one of the shorter pieces, and I worked on it. I'd never done it before. Well, come to find out, if you'd worked on one of the pieces, they were going to throw you on a concert that night.
Great. Oh, joy.
Cool. But out of nowhere, just he decided that he liked me. So we did a free improvisation that he just called in the middle of the concert. So he was playing piano, I was playing soprano, and we did a free improv for about 10 minutes. And I walked off stage at the end, and he kept playing, and he looked at me, and he gestured for me to come back. We went another 5 minutes. And after that, he just came up and gave me this big bear hug. And Francois is such a warm, wonderful person. I took the chance a couple months later. I sent him a message and said, it was such a joy to play with you. It was such a joy to meet you, work with you. Would you be interested in writing a small piece for me? And I didn't hear anything for a couple of weeks. And I said, well, it was worth a shot. And then about a week later, he sends me a message and says, the piece is almost ready. Here are a couple ideas for the name. What do you think? And I'm like, fantastic.
Yeah, and then, wow, we skipped a couple steps on that one.
Exactly. Exactly. It was fantastic. And then Robert Lemay. Robert's, of course, a great friend of the saxophone and just a beautiful human being. Just excellent, excellent person. Warm, friendly, kind, and incredibly intelligent, really deep person. And he had just come to a Navy Band Sax Symposium to hear some pieces. And he just, for chance, came to my recital, liked what he heard, and said, I like you. You're my discovery. And I said, well thank you very much.
What a compliment.
And we started talking, and he's written a couple of great pieces for me now. He wrote just a really lovely solo soprano piece called Into Thin Air. And then he wrote a small piece for saxophone and snare called Kif Kif for my saxophone percussion duo with the great Gordon Hicken, my musical friend and colleague and brother. And again, it's all about the relationships. Music is great, but if you're building a relationship with a composer, if you know their music inside and out, and if they know you not only as a performer and what you can do, which is very important, but they know your personality, they know your aesthetic, they know your likes and dislikes, your demeanor, they're going to write something that's so much more meaningful. Mm-hmm. I love commissions. I love pooling resources and getting big pieces, and I think that's very important. But there's a lot to be said for that one-on-one personal connection of going back and forth with one performer, one composer, and creating something that's truly original, unique, that hopefully is going to have enough personality beyond that individual performer that can go out into the world. Now, having said that, I'm also very excited working on some excellent, excellent, excellent new possibilities with a bunch of chamber ensembles, including the Palmetto Quartet. So be tuned in for some more interesting collaborations with composers in the future.
That's exciting stuff. Yeah, that's great. I love that. I've definitely played some pieces by some of the composers you mentioned. They're very, very fun. And I think at one point, Jesse Jones was my theory professor at USC. So it's very interesting how paths cross.
Well, and if you haven't checked it out, check out his Lita monologue, which he wrote for me, and I premiered at the Strasbourg World Sax Congress. It's on the Rogue 2 record. It is a fantastic piece, and it's not quite like anything I've ever played. He does all of this really interesting rhythmic interplay, these interior melodies that you're playing against yourself, these cross rhythms that you're playing against yourself. It's very technically demanding, but at its heart, it's extremely lyrical, extremely musical. And that's one of the many pieces that I've had the opportunity to bring to the world that I am an advocate for. I love the piece. I love the thought behind it. So anybody out there, get a hold of Jesse Jones, get Leave the Monologue, get a hold of Robert, get Into Thin Air, which is now published. But check these pieces out, because it's not just me. I'm just very fortunate and very happy to be the first person who got to play them, but I definitely don't want to be the last person to play them because they're great pieces.
For sure. I love that. Yeah, those interactions with composers definitely are a lot of fun. But transitioning out of that, I know I have to ask just because I'm so curious. Of course, you are a member of the Palmetto Saxophone Quartet, which entails being in a quartet with your old professor, Dr. Lehman. I'm curious what that was like at the beginning, what it's like now. And of course, you mentioned before, he's done really well at treating you like a colleague, but it still must have been a little awkward at first playing in a quartet with your professor.
You know, I have enough distance. I wasn't totally thinking about this until recently, but I have been out of grad school for 8 years now, mm-hmm. 8 years in December. And I've been,
yeah, I think I saw your last doctoral recital in my freshman year.
Oh, geez. Yeah. Because we never even met because I was teaching in, I think you came and said, hey, at the end of the recital, but mm-hmm. I was teaching in North Dakota. The last semester I was technically enrolled and I just came in and did my recital that fall, in fall of 2013. And, yeah, that was wild, man. North Dakota.
That's quite the distance to travel for a single recital.
As a Tennessean with a beloved spouse who is a Georgian, I am very happy to be in Georgia.
Yeah.
You know, with Cliff, there was that distance, but also with him, he's a consummate professional. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what it would be like with other teachers. Obviously, every teacher has a different personality, different demeanor. And Cliff is, obviously, when you're his student, you know, it's a great relationship, but it's a clear student-teacher relationship. But the moment you leave, he's so good about just turning that switch. Mm-hmm. And he's always been great about that. You know, we've always met up at conferences and anytime we were together. But with the little passage of years and with his attitude in general, it just felt really, really comfortable being mm-hmm. in a quartet with him. And being in a quartet with Sheldon Johnson and Neil Postma, who are also old students of Cliff's, who are consummate professionals, excellent musicians.
For sure.
At this point, it's just, we had to take some time off because of the pandemic, just when we were really getting rolling as a quartet. So I'm cautiously optimistic, you know, we're all in a position that hopefully, as long as this doesn't get too much worse, we can keep doing our thing, I hope. But it's just very comfortable. You have four people who know each other very well, who have a very similar aesthetic, who know where we're all coming from because we have that mm-hmm. shared experience. And I think that's something that you only get from people that you either went to school with or people that you've studied with or a combination of both, mm-hmm. That you already know each other as musicians so thoroughly that you already are on the same page from a musical standpoint, a sound standpoint. It's so much easier to be a cohesive ensemble as professionals when you can only get together, you know, every month or two. Yeah. It makes all the difference in the world. Well, and as you know, your great teacher, Jeff Dybul, they all went to school with each other. They were able to establish this beautiful, beautiful aesthetic that is the H2 sound. And now they can get together four or five times a year when they're spread all across the country. It's still like that beautiful, beautiful, precise, great sound that they have. Mm. And there are only a couple ways that you can do that.
For sure. I do want to spend some time highlighting projects that you're working on, things that you mentioned before, like the quartet has some stuff in the works. So is there anything that you'd like to highlight right now?
Absolutely. So the quartet, we are again, cautiously optimistically planning for a great mini tour throughout the Southeast. We're hammering down dates right now, but pay attention to social media. There should be some concerts coming up in March. We have a great, premiere of a wonderful piece that I don't want to totally spill the beans on yet, but hopefully that will be coming at the NASA conference in Oklahoma. Also, a lot of my other chamber ensembles. I am a member of Rogue 2 with, again, the great Gordon Hicken, both a South Carolina and Florida State alum, by the way.
Oh, nice.
One of the greatest musicians I've ever had the pleasure of working with. We're on a temporary pause. He's in Baltimore, and he has had some very, very happy family life changes that are going on. So he's going to get settled in with a new little Hicken before too long. And then we are, after that, pretty shortly going to be playing an East Coast tour with some new music. I also have the Allen Duo. My wife, Elise, is an incredible band director, researcher, thinker, artist, and she's also a great flutist. So we have the opportunity when she's not doing marching band, we get to do some flute saxophone repertoire. We get a couple new pieces on the line that we should be trotting out pretty soon. And I've got some research projects in the bag. Be looking out for an article, hopefully in this next Sax Symposium, on Hans Eisler, who is a Weimar-era composer. Very political, worked a lot with Bertolt Brecht, and used the saxophone extensively in his work. He's very well known in Germany still. The main conservatory in Berlin is the Hans Eisler Conservatory, but he's very little known in the U.S., even though he worked and lived here, was nominated for an Academy Award, but he was hounded out very early in the McCarthy era. So be looking for that, some very interesting music. But I'm just hoping onward and upward, and we get past all the stuff.
Yes, and, it is time.
It's time. So
just so people have a little bit more knowledge of where to access some of the stuff that you've already talked about, where can we find some of your publications or some of the CDs you've talked about or anything that we've talked about so far? Is there like a centralized location, or is there specific places that we can look for those?
Absolutely. First, check my website, alansax.com. It has links to a lot of my recordings with Rogue 2, some recordings with Annie Nykirk, some recordings with another one of my quartet projects, the Saga Quartet back in Texas. Has a lot of links and resources for my publications and just a lot of other things. You can kind of keep tabs on my career and figure out what we're doing. Follow the Palmetto Saxophone Quartet at Palmetto Saxophone Quartet on Facebook and Instagram. Rogue 2 at Rogue 2 on Facebook. But check us out, and hopefully very soon we'll be playing somewhere near you.
I definitely hope to hear you guys soon. Well, I wanted to thank you again for coming on the show. It's been a long time since I've wanted to have you on the show, and I'm finally glad we got to make it happen. I really appreciate all you've done for the saxophone because you're so prolific with rewriting and performing and commissioning. So it's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Well, it's been a great pleasure to talk to you. I'm a big fan of your work. I'm a big fan of the podcast. I've really enjoyed listening to all of these wonderful interviews that you've done, and I'm just very happy to be a part of it all.
Thanks for listening.